Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. There are two sides to the debate over climate change. There are those who are panicked that human beings are the prime cause and doing nothing to curb the inevitable, and those who vehemently deny that humans are the main cause or even that it exists at all. Well, meanwhile, folks like Professor Donald Rod Bell, chair of Union College's Geology Department, are measuring it and documenting it. Donald Rod Bell has focused his research on documenting the geologic record of global climate change. His work has centered on the Andes Mountains of Peru and Ecuador, where he tracked the fluctuations of mountain glaciers and recorded El Nino events preserved in lake deposits. Professor Rod Bell received his PhD in geology from the University of Colorado. His work has been widely published in journals ranging from the Journal of Quaternary Science to Nature. At Union, he teaches courses in climate change, glacial geology, and lake sedimentology. Your calls right now. Get in line. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can also get in touch with us online. Go to Facebook, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email voxpop@WAMC.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Professor Rod Bell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray. It's great to be here. And I understand I'm sitting in Alan's chair.
You're sitting in Alan's chair.
It's a true honor.
Really? You'd expect a throne, right? But no. No, it's just a regular chair. Well, nice to have you here. And, you know, you told me before the show started, you have actually been on these airwaves way back when and did segments for the Environment Show in the 90s.
I believe it was around 95 or 96.
Wow, yes. That's amazing. Yeah. At the long lamented gone Environment Show. Well, it sure is great to have you here. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do? I think it's fascinating how you are trying to document climate change by going into the geologic record. So let's start with what you do.
Okay, so you know, one of the things that many climate scientists, or we call ourselves paleoclimatologists, those who study past climate, that is the climate changes that happened before the instrumental record, one of the things we are concerned about is understanding the natural variability in Earth's climate, because we know that Earth's climate has rarely, if ever, been stable. It's always changed through cycles that are related to orbital variations, through cycles that are related to the El Nino Southern Oscillation and the other oscillators in the climate system. And so the logic here is that if we want to be able to accurately predict what our climate future is going to hold and how much of the current warming is truly driven by human activities and anthropogenic sources, we need to know what that climate that natural variability is to essentially subtract it from the record that we see. So I have been working in the Andes for over 30 years, and we look at lake sediments and the records that they contain that tell us about the proximity of glaciers to the lakes and El Nino storms and the like. So we generally go up every summer, which is winter down there. We go up to the high lakes of the Andes that are surrounded by glaciers, most of which are retreating today, and we take sediment cores out. And some of these cores go back 10,000 years. We just took one last summer on a very large project that we think may go back over 100,000 years. To try and understand how tropical climate variability has been and what the frequency and amplitude of that change has been.
What have you found?
Well, it's at the same time, I should point out that there are teams of people going all over the world doing this.
And you would need that.
Absolutely. It's a huge undertaking. And not just lakes. I mean, they're looking at cores from the polar glaciers, cores from tropical mountain glaciers in Africa and south in the Andes. And ocean cores and tree rings, and there are so many archives natural archives of climate, and everybody's looking in a different corner of the world to try and put all the pieces of the puzzle together. It's a fascinating area of work, and no one person could possibly get to it all.
Who's in charge of putting all the pieces of the puzzle together?
Well, we get together at national meetings every year and give talks, and of course the gold standard of science is peer-reviewed publications.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't exist doing research for very long without publishing our results, and that gets into the scientific realm, and then everybody can see it and build on it or shoot it down, and that's the scientific process.
Do you think 10,000 years is far enough back to go? It's a mere blink of an eye in the grand scheme of things. Yeah.
Well, there are records that go back quite a bit further than that, but we get a good sense in 10,000 and a better sense in 20. It depends on what you're really after. There tends to be that the longer, the shorter time window, say for example 10,000 years, you can see more detail. You could see El Nino events, but if you're getting records that go back millions of years, the one El Nino will blur into another, and you really can't see it. So you really sort of design your scientific mission around a problem that you're trying to address.
Mm. So, and of course, science, it's tough to pin down exact answers. But if I had to say, Don, what percentage of the current climate change, as you see it, is caused by human stuff?
Well, I'm not going to put a number on it, but I'd say the vast majority of it.
Really?
If you start back at the late 1700s with the invention of the steam engine, James Watt, that largely marked the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and CO2 levels, we know from ice cores, begin to rise at that point. Now, we can go back and look at long records of CO2 in the atmosphere recorded in glacial ice, which is a whole other branch of study, fascinating study to capture samples of the atmosphere preserved in bubbles of ice. That was a huge hurdle that was scientifically developed back in the 80s. And we know that over the last several hundred thousand years, we haven't had CO2 levels in the atmosphere above about 300 parts per million. And that's where we were in the late 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
And we've busted through 400, and we're steaming ahead now.
Okay.
So,
well, the phone lines are loading up here. So before we get too much further, let's take a call or two. 800-348-2551 is the number. We're joined by Professor Donald Rudd Bell today of Union College. And let's go to Joan Marie in Smallwood. Joan Marie, you're on.
Professor, thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm a housewife. My question is small, but there are many of us on the planet. I live in the Catskill Mountains in Smallwood. Now, I have a granddaughter who's 4. I'm older, much older. How is this? And I don't want to discuss whether we caused it or not, because the Earth is round, period. I've seen the photo from space. How is this Earth warming going to affect me in my lifetime and in my 4-year-old granddaughter's lifetime? I want her to inherit the house. How will it affect? What will the beach water be like? What will my home, my winters, my summers be like?
Wow, that's a huge question.
I kind of know. And the second question is, all these countries got together. I forget how many. They were talking about it. They all signed a paper about Earth warming.
Yes.
How's it going to affect me in my house? I'm sitting out here. Here we go. So please, I'll listen.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Thank you, Joan. That's a very good question.
Okay.
Well, you recall Hurricane Irene that ripped through the Catskills, and you probably remember that very well from a few years ago. So these tropical storms that feed off of warm ocean water are expected to become more frequent and perhaps even stronger going forward. So that devastated the Schoharie Valley, and that of course drains right north of from the Catskills northward, and devastated much of New England and upstate New York. Those events have been quite widespread, or at least I should say spaced out over time, perhaps on the scale of one per century. And we just saw a century event here in the northeastern U.S. We might expect to see more of those. And also in terms of winters, you asked about winters. I think the winter we just had might be the model for the middle part and toward the end of this century. That's what the modelers tell us, that you take a normal winter down around, say, Maryland, Virginia, and that's what the winters here in New England are going to be like in the middle to late latter part of this this century.
Mm. Okay, and of course the hurricanes, we've had a rather a dearth of hurricanes that have really hit the East Coast in the last several years. So my question for you as a scientist, and we have to go to a break here, and I'll come back and get the answer. When you see an event, a huge event, like Irene. Is there a danger from of extrapolating too much from one data point?
Sure, absolutely, and that's one of the real problems with taking an event and ascribing it to global warming, because prior to the anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, we had hurricanes. We have geologic records of hurricanes going back
right.
through time.
And so that's really what you're looking at, things like this going back in time before we had an effect.
Yes, understanding the frequency and how it's changing, it becomes very important.
Fascinating. And our guest today is Professor Donald Rodbell, or Rod Bell? How do I say your last
Rod
name?
Bell.
Rod Bell.
Yes.
Okay, we'll take a break here. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be back.
They may fix the weather in the wild, just like Mr. But tell me, what's to be done? Oh, about the weather in my head.
Support for WMC comes from Curtis Lumber, providing home improvement products and advice to homeowners and contractors, supporting local communities for over a century. CurtisLumber.com. Union Gables Mansion in Saratoga Springs, celebrating 25 years of preserving the Victorian mansion with gardens, wraparound porches, Romanesque pool, fountains, and more, UnionGables.com. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre. The Montessori School of the Berkshires, dedicated to engaging the natural curiosity of children, toddler through eighth grade, now enrolling for fall 2016, BerkshireMontessori.org. And Interactive Media Consulting, Saratoga Springs, New York, providing logo and print design, web development, and digital marketing throughout the capital region and beyond, marketing creative and business ideas since 1996, imediaconsult.com.
Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number to call is 800-348-2551. We talk climate change with geologist Donald Rodbell of Union College's Geology Department. And he has spent 20-plus years studying this stuff, huh?
At least.
How did you start doing this?
Well, back in the 80s, when I was in graduate school studying climate change, natural variability of climate change, there really wasn't much of a global warming debate or hot topic at that time, and my colleagues and I that were interested in it were purely for academic. Earth historians. We want to understand all there is to understand about the Earth, and in this sub-discipline, it is how is Earth's climate? How did the ice ages come and go? That was the big focus back in the 80s. Was the ice ages?
And you think about the way the ice age left us. Again, over the grand scheme of time, it was so quick.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, there were many ice ages, but...
The last one.
Back in the 80s, we thought there had been four, and now we know there were dozens, much higher frequency variability. But, it was a fairly irrelevant sort of... It wasn't relevant societally at the time to be studying past climate. And suddenly we found ourselves relevant in the mid to late 90s when it became important to be able to say more about what natural variability is.
There was a time in the 70s when it was also relevant, because I remember maybe more than one of the major news magazines, whether it was Time or Newsweek, I can't remember,
right.
said, the coming ice age.
The coming of the ice age, right.
Well, we were okay so far.
Hey, we survived it.
Yeah. So you had mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation about the orbit around the sun. Where are we in that grand orbit?
Well, we are, not surprisingly, on an orbit around the sun. That orbit changes shape.
That's what I mean.
And from being slightly more circular to being a bit more elliptical. And we call that eccentricity. And that's got a very long periodicity to that change. It's about 100,000 years from going from being a little bit more circular to being a little bit more elliptical. And there's two other parameters about our configuration of our orbit. And one of them is the tilt of the Earth's axis. So it tilts a little bit more or less, and there's about a 40,000-year beat to that change. And then there's a wobble to the axis. It's like a top wobbling on a table as it goes around the sun. So all of those three, and they're driven by the gravitational pull of the large planets in our solar system. It was figured out in a fascinating way in the 1920s by Milutin Milankovic, Serbian mathematician, wasn't proven until long after his death when we started to get climate records that had these beats to them, the 100,000, the 40,000, and the 20,000-year beat of precession. So right now we are, and those are the beats that really drive the ice ages. And so one of the issues about climate change, that the ongoing warming right now, is that we actually should be cooling very slowly into the next ice age.
Interesting.
But we're not. We're going very much in the other direction. And that has never happened in the geologic records that we have that go back hundreds of thousands of years. We have never seen an interglacial time period that lasts, and they normally last about 12,000 years. This one began about 12,000 years ago. Huh. So we should be slowly sliding into the next ice age as driven by these orbital parameters.
So these orbital parameters then, to some extent, if what you're saying is true, perhaps are slowing this down, slowing this process down.
They on a very slow, you know, these kinds of the sliding into the next ice age takes millennia to happen. So on a decadal sort of time scale like we're talking about here, or even a century time scale, there's not a whole lot of pull in a cooling direction. But yes, we are to see this, the kind of warming that we see today. It is completely anomalous.
Interesting.
When we look back through time.
How about sunspots and sunspot cycles? Do you do studies of magnetized lava and such, as far as looking at the sunspots and the frequency and their effect on climate?
Yeah. Well, so solar intensity, of course, affects the radiative balance of the planet. But since about 1975 or so, the solar intensity has actually been waning while our temperature has been rising. So it's hard to make the claim that the temperature rise that we see today is somehow driven by a greater solar forcing.
No, but it does have some effect.
Oh,
in other
yes.
words, there was that much-discussed Maunder minimum.
There have been sunspot cycles that we know from the crazy people looking at the sun and actually counting sunspots back hundreds of years. Keeping track, and so they are inversely scaled to solar intensity, so the sun has had gone through periods where it has been more energetic.
We had a period where there were no sunspots recently, right?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
I believe so.
The most recent sunspot.
Ham radio operators were complaining about it all left and right. All right, here's an email, and then we'll go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. This one's from Bill. Questions. Is it fair to say that weather instability is aggravated by the increased energy resulting from global warming? That's one. You want to go with that first?
Sure, that's fine. Well, just in a really basic level, when we have warmer sea surface temperatures and a warmer atmosphere, we have the capacity in the atmosphere to hold more water vapor. And that's a strong feedback just by itself, because water vapor is the largest, most abundant greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. And it's not something that we are pumping in as humans into the atmosphere, but it's a feedback on the warming that's going on. And that is that the atmosphere is capable of holding more water vapor. There's more evaporation going on. And it also, the warmer atmosphere also invigorates the hydrologic cycle. So the whole hydrologic cycle now is juiced. In addition, you throw in hurricanes that derive their energy from warm sea surface temperatures. That's why we normally get them at the end of the summer season, when sea surface temperatures are at their maximum. We don't normally get a hurricane in March or February, when the North Atlantic is cold. And whether they're typhoons or hurricanes, they're basically the same beast.
Yeah.
And so you add more heat to the surface layer of the oceans, and you're going to expect to see stronger, larger amplitude. Whether they become more frequent or not is a harder one to know, but certainly it's not a big stretch in logic to be concerned about more vigorous hydrologic cycle and hurricanes.
All right, Don, here's part two of Bill's question, and then we'll go back to the phones. Part two, are there websites where people can find out about the science and data of climate change in an organized fashion, as you might in a well-taught course?
There are one that's a good one. I think is called I believe it's skepticalscience.com,
mm-hmm.
and it discusses a lot of the climate issues that you hear about. For example, solar forcing, and it provides you with an elementary assessment of that question, and you can look at it from a more advanced level. It's quite good. I would also recommend that the IPCC documents, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has put out a synopsis for lay people to read and government officials to read to spin up on the understanding of climate. And the IPCC reports are all available.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you for that email. Back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Let's go to our old buddy Eli in New Hartford, New York. Eli, you're on.
Thank you. I know little about the science of global warming, but I do know that every major American scientific organization has said that global warming is real, it's very serious, and it is man-made. And we have to take steps to allay the consequences. Organizations as diverse as NASA, to the American Medical Association, Association for the Advancement of Science, right on down through the gamut of American Biological Institute, Geological Institute, the Chemical Institute, all of them. And you could go to their websites for any people who don't believe and find that, because they have pages describing their attitudes. But we have, in our country, the major political force which denies the reality, our Republican Party. We saw the debates where the gentleman stood up in a row and denied any knowledge that there was a problem, that they're not scientists, their response. Any opinion on how we stop this ignorance and how we get the American people to finally foist upon our political system the required attitude to take steps and alleviate the problem?
All right, Eli, thanks a lot for the call.
That's a very good question, and I try to stay away from the political side of this, but it's virtually impossible to. You know, global warming is sort of the perfect storm for politicization of science, because if you are of the opinion that we want to have a small government and not an intrusive government in our lives, which for which there's lots of good reasons to think, it becomes almost impossible to accept the existence of global warming, because the solutions to it almost invariably involve and require a more widespread regulatory framework, and one that's not even national but global. So it's sort of a nightmare solution to those who strongly advocate for small government. Now, I think you don't walk away from this problem. It's just way too serious. So I've been teaching a large enrollment course at Union College to try and educate the student body as much as I can on the topic, and I just left class to come here. And one of the things that I told them today was that I want you folks to be educated on the science behind climate change, so that when you get into a discussion with somebody who is a doubter or a skeptic or whatever term you want to use there, you are armed with information, and so I think education is critical. But obviously, we can't teach everybody the science of climate change. It's available. Now, I think the more we have these extreme weather events, it becomes much harder to continue to ignore it. And as we've seen, you know, even the Pentagon has come out and stated that climate change poses a national security risk to the United States. Now, if you look at it from those, and that's probably true because of the displacement of people that will almost certainly occur in the future, and the potential radicalization of those folks, people are not going to wither on the vine quietly. And so when you get the Pentagon, which is hardly a bastion of left-wing extremists, arguing that climate change poses a national security risk, you've entered a new realm. And I think what you need to do when you talk to people who don't believe it, you need to approach them from perspectives that they can listen to. So when you talk to a hardcore right winger, well, then you talk to them about security issues and how the displacement of people because of water resources in far-flung regions of the world could come home and affect us from a national security standpoint.
Our guest is Professor Donald Rod Bell of Union College. Philosophically, are politics the natural enemy of science?
No, I think we're in a very unusual time period where it has become vogue on the part of scientists or politicians to dismiss science, and it's quite alarming. I mean, if you go back, I haven't been on the planet for that long, but you go back a few decades, and it was very, very different. Science was highly respected, and when we don't challenge a medical doctor who gives you or recommends a treatment for I say it's a mainstream treatment for a serious disease, you wouldn't come out and challenge their opinion on it, but somehow it becomes it's okay to challenge the scientific consensus, the very strong consensus on where we are with climate change. So it's driven largely by where people are ideologically.
Okay, yeah. And you would, of course, agree that doubt is one of the key things in your line of work, so consensus doesn't always mean a great deal.
Sure, but let's use the scientific process and the scientific method, which feeds on skepticism. As scientists, we're very skeptical.
You have to be.
We have to publish our results in peer-reviewed journals. The data has to go out to sources where everybody can get at it, and it's read and critiqued. And if you're not right, scientists are not all that.
They could be an ornery bunch.
Apologetic about going after you.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Andy in Ferrisburg, Vermont. You're on.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, Andy.
I have a question about local Pleistocene geology. So I was running around the hills in Vermont, and I saw what looked like a deltaic kind of well-sorted sand with a bunch of boulders and cobbles on top. So the sand was deposited in still water, probably. How did the boulders and cobbles get on top of that?
Well, that's a good question. I'd have to see the outcrop. But one of the fascinating things about our region is that we were at the southern margin of the Laurentide Ice Sheet. It reached as far south as Long Island. And when it was retreating, it sat about at this latitude at about 15,000 years ago for quite some time and oscillated back and forth. And it dammed its own meltwater drainage so that there were lakes formed that were very large lakes all over the landscape. So you probably saw the delta of a stream that was entering an ancient glacial lake, which is now, of course, gone. And it's possible that the glacier advanced over its own deposit, its own lake deposits.
They were deposited by the sole of the glacier on a re-advance or a retreat.
That's right. The margin was oscillating for several thousand years.
So I was introduced to this love of sand by James Dineen. Have you crossed paths with him?
Yes, I have.
Great. Is he still practicing?
I'm not sure.
Great.
Andy, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye now. 800-348-2551. All right, Don, this one came in via email from Peter. Sirs. I don't like it when they start with sirs. The deniers keep referencing a level of global temperature for some recent period. Wasn't this traced to a calibration problem with the monitors and corrected? I only heard about this one time. That's from Peter. He called you sir, so be careful.
I'm now knighted.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what he's referring to, but there has been a. I'll look at the email.
I'll just whistle a tune here while you're reading.
Well, okay. So, wasn't there a trace to a calibration problem? Okay. So, one of the things you'll see in the climate skeptics literature is that warming has slowed down, or that
there was the 18-year pause that Senator Cruz mentioned in hearings year ago or half
so
a year ago.
Last year it was 17. The year before that it was 16. Because they're pinning it to 1998, which until this year was the strongest El Nino event that had ever been recorded.
This was a strong one this year, right?
And what happened, absolutely, and what happens during El Nino events is that the warm Western Pacific warm pools leaks eastward across the Pacific and radiates heat out into the atmosphere. So when you get a big El Nino year, and we'll see it again this year, we're going to set a new record for temperatures this year, partially because of greenhouse gases. But superimposed on that is this massive El Nino event. And if you go back to 98, it was an enormous spike in global temperatures. And if you start your temperature record comparison then and move forward, you can the next year was actually cooler than 98. So if you want to try and game the statistics a little bit here, you start your temperature, your interval of concern with 98, and that's what you see. Now, the other thing I think you may have been talking about, calibration, the satellite data were for a while, and that I think it was at least 10 or 15 years ago, not in a total agreement in terms of the magnitude of warming with ground-based temperature measurements, and there was a calibration problem.
All right, we have to take a break here. Our guest today is Professor Donald Rudd Bell of Union College, and we'll be back.
Support for WMC comes from Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony. Locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. Carrie Haddad Gallery, presenting abstract paintings, watercolors, fire-scorched drawings, and Venetian plaster wall sculpture through May 22nd. Open daily, carriehaddadgallery.com. Mango Tree Imports, hosting children's illustrator Elizabeth Zunin on Saturday, May 14th, for a book reading and children's activities at 1 p.m. at the Saratoga store. MangoTreeImports.com and Facebook. The Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for 25 years, independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley, lathrop.kendall.org. And Poughkeepsie Farm Project, connecting food, farm, and community, organically grown CSA shares now available for the 2016 season, farmproject.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC. I'm Ray Graff. We're joined today by Professor Donald Rudd Bell of Union College, and we talk climate change at 800-348-2551. Back to the phones, and Elliot in Lenox, Mass. Elliot, you're on.
Hi. Good to hear your voice, and it's an interesting show. I've got a question for the professor. I accept the fact that global warming is caused largely by what humans are doing, but I'm also seeing that China and India, the two largest countries in the world, primarily are still using coal as their primary source for energy. And my question is, if we take a look at the realistic projections of the type of energy they're using, are there projections using realistic assumptions of how much longer we're going to be increasing the amount of CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere? And if so, are there projections of how much more damage, more serious climate change effects, et cetera? But are there realistic projections, and how much longer is CO2 going to be increasing?
Okay.
That's a very good question, and yes, it has been explicitly dealt with by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They have generated a series of model outputs that use as input varying assumptions about how much carbon-based fuel we're as a globe we're going to be emitting, and the so-called business as usual model, which is the scariest one, is the one in which we do nothing about curbing our carbon footprint. And if you do that, you get results in this century that are well in excess of 2 or 3 degrees C of warming, which is what the Paris Accord agreed to keep us below. So there are any number, there's an infinite number of possible inputs, depending on how aggressive we become as a species to reduce our carbon output. And you know, I think that the Paris Accord is important because it got 186 nations to agree to become carbon neutral sometime in the middle of the century. And that's a big step. And if we can, and that includes China and the United States.
Yeah, but what my real question is, given what the realistic assumptions are, give me a year in which the CO2 will stop increasing.
Okay, so the other thing about CO2 is it's very long-lived in the atmosphere. It's got a residence time of about a century. So what we put up today will be up there for 100 years. And that's why it is such a problem, is that it just builds up. So if we could take a fairly aggressive stance, we could probably, I think optimistically, by the middle to latter part of this century, reach carbon neutrality. That is, reach a stable level of, that's the idea behind the Paris Accord, that would, so I can't give you a date, but I would say the middle to latter part of the century is a fairly optimistic
goal. That's pretty scary, given that we're already seeing the climate, more storms, et cetera. If we're going to have another 50 years of increasing CO2, that's a problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the IPCC put out a fairly arbitrary limit, that temperature limit, a warming limit of 2 degrees, which is significant. And they think that beyond that, so-called tipping points become very much more likely. And that's one of the more alarming aspects of the paleoclimate record, are these tipping points, which we see having been crossed in the past. Naturally, we've never triggered one ourselves.
Elliot, thank you for the call. We appreciate it very much. Our number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Charlie in Delanson. Charlie.
Hello. Yes, I have a question for the doctor. My concern is about the continued existence of the human race. We have people that call themselves preppers, and they're storing all sorts of foods and things, and while they're denying any change in the climate or anything else, but they're only prepared to take care of their own little holdings. And my concern is, if global warming continues or escalates to a point that it has a real serious, undeniable effect on us, what is the likelihood, the most reasonable likelihood, that humans will do? Evolve or mutate?
Okay, well, that's a toughie. All right, Charlie, thank you for that. What do you think,
that's
Doc?
That's a little bit out of my league, but I will say that, 10, 15 years ago, it was all about mitigation, stopping the warming. And there was sort of a debate in the environmental science community about whether we should adapt to the warming that is going to happen, or whether we should stop it and focus our efforts on stopping it.
You do both, right?
Now we know that we can't stop it. It's happening, and it will continue to happen for decades, and we need to adapt to it. And so that's, we do need a infrastructure that is capable of withstanding the kinds of storms that we might be looking at. The scary aspects of climate change are how it affects our ability to agriculture and the displacement of what you can grow where.
Yeah.
We can't just move wholesale large agribusinesses.
And I think that point is what the Pentagon talks about as far as security issues.
Sure, and it's probably more driven by changes in rainfall patterns.
Yep.
And moisture balance. A few degrees isn't going to really reduce your ability to grow some crops. But if it dries out and we see these long-standing droughts, which we've seen in the southwestern U.S. for quite some time. Now, this year they got a reprieve, but, the long-term trend and the forecasts are for continued droughts in parts of the world that can ill afford water loss.
What about the carbon dioxide levels, say 500 million years ago or a billion years ago?
Okay, so if I could just, yes, CO2 has varied in the atmosphere for its own reasons, for natural reasons, and we can get into that.
We have 10 minutes left.
Okay, but I won't get into it, but I'll just say that if you go back into the Cretaceous and into the Jurassic, so now you're talking about beyond about 65 million years ago, when the dinosaurs were roaming the planet, there wasn't an ice cube of ice on the planet.
Yeah.
It was warm, and there were broadleaf trees growing on both poles, and these large creatures were feeding off of that very productive biomass, and CO2 levels were up about 1,000 parts per million or higher, we think. And that's 3 or 4 times the pre-industrial levels have been here.
Yeah.
But there are very good reasons for why CO2 was that high. There was a breakup of Pangaea that happened prior to that, accelerated volcanism. And so CO2 can come out of volcanoes, and if you increase the level of volcanism on the planet, you can, over a very long time span, increase CO2 levels.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mike in Poughkeepsie. Mike, you're on.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just wondering about what he thinks about, in an effort to stop global warming, as far as how he feels about, geoengineering or spraying particles into the atmosphere to stop the climate change?
Okay, very good question. That falls into the bin of mitigation. How do we minimize the amount of warming? And there are some pretty cool ideas that have been put forth. One of them, none of which have been attempted on a large scale. One of them is carbon sequestration, to actually suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and bury it back into the rocks from where it came. Now, if we can do that one, we've cracked the Rosetta Stone of the climate problem.
It's got to be an expensive process.
Very expensive process, but it can be done, and the place you do it would be at the where it's most concentrated, out of the stacks of the, say, coal-fired power plants. And if you put that CO2 into carbonate bedrock at depth, the carbonate bedrock will neutralize the carbon, turn it into bicarbonate, which is harmless. So there's a way of, at least on paper, of doing this. And the great sequesters of carbon naturally, of course, are the biomass and the trees and everything that photosynthesizes. And so another line of thinking is that one might fertilize the oceans and get them to become more productive and make more algae. And that, of course, draws atmospheric CO2 levels. They die, the algae falls to the bottom, and you've essentially taken the CO2 from the atmosphere and put it on the bottom of the ocean.
So just planting more trees won't do it?
The problem with trees is that they grow and then they die, and unless you harvest
them, yeah.
If you harvest them and build things out of them and keep the wood from rotting, then, and if we used wood much more so than we do now, and kept that wood from and preserved that wood, we are essentially tying up the carbon in the wood, not letting it go back to the atmosphere. But once that tree on the forest floor begins to rot, the CO2 goes right back into the atmosphere.
All right, let's go to Tom in Housatonic. Tom, you're on.
Hi. In 1978, I was taking an undergraduate course at UMass. It was a geography course in climate change, and we studied, ocean core, tree ring, all the different methods that you're using to study this today. And the professor was Richard Bradley. And I think I was wondering,
yeah, that's Ray Bradley.
Where this guy has to. Later on, I read that he, his research, led to a lot of the ideas about modern global warming being a result of human influence. They called it the hockey stick effect, I believe.
That's right. That his name is Ray Bradley, and he's one of the luminaries in our field. I know him well. He's worked in the Arctic and Coors Lakes, and he's really an amazing fellow.
Hi.
The hockey stick that you refer to is what the graph of global temperature and CO2 looks like if you were to put a hockey stick on its side. The blade of the stick is a 20th century warming, and or 20th century CO2 or many other variables in the climate system.
Okay. Tom, thanks a lot. It's not the hockey puck effect.
It's the hockey stick.
All right, let's go over to Mary in Delmar. Mary, you're on.
Yes. A few years ago, there was a lot of talk about the climate actually getting colder in the Northeast as the Gulf Stream was pushed further south by the melting of the glaciers in the Arctic. I'm wondering if that's still a possibility or if that's been discredited.
The very good question, Mary, and some of the outcomes of global warming that we're concerned about are counterintuitive, like short-term cooling. And in small parts of the world, such as the northeastern U.S., and whether or not it reaches this far south or not is a good question. But basically what you're describing is a shutdown of thermohaline circulation, which is happening in the North Atlantic, and it's what brings tropical heat into the North Atlantic region today and warms much of Western Europe. And if you think about the temperature in London, which is at a higher latitude than it is in, than is New York City, London has much warmer winters than does New York because of the heat that blows along the westerlies off the Gulf Stream, which is this great conveyor belt of heat that moves the tropical warmth up into the high. Now, if you shut that down, why would you shut it down? You would shut it down because of melting of Greenland, which is freshening the water. So one of the reasons the conveyor belt works is that you form sea ice at high latitudes, and when sea ice forms, salt is rejected from the ice, and the seawater that remains becomes saltier and denser, and it dives down to the bottom of the Atlantic, and it draws more tropical water up to replace it. It's like a giant conveyor belt at the supermarket. And if you were to dilute the salt content of the North Atlantic with melting Greenland ice, you could, over a short period of time, upset that delicate salt balance so much that the conveyor belt stops. And there was a popular movie about this, I can't remember the name of it, about the shutdown event and the ice coming out of the north. And it was, as some of these are, about 1% based on truth. But the thermohaline shutdown is, and it's very sensitive. It's only really in the Southern Ocean around Antarctica and in the North Atlantic.
Let's see if we can get another call or two in here before the end of the program. Carol in Del Mar. Carol, you're on.
Hi, I'm a scientific person. I've measured carbon dioxide for many, many years as part of my work, more than I'd want to admit. And I'm working with Solarize Albany, and I'm really concerned about our inability to have conversations about the climate issue. And I hear a lot of people who say, yeah, well, I'm thinking about solar or renewable or an energy audit. They don't seem to realize the need to really get going with that how crucial this issue is to try to solve on many fronts, both politically, stopping the fossil fuel industry from encouraging new development. And I wonder, do you have any suggestions how we can encourage people to have conversations and to think, I need to take responsibility myself personally by doing, say, a solar installation and an energy audit, maybe considering a windmill if it's appropriate for my area, signing up for community net metering or for community wind. Any ideas as to how we can address that inertia?
Good question. This is the crux of the problem. And I think part of the problem lies with the media. And I'll point back to Ray here, if you don't mind, Ray.
That's fine.
When he introduced this topic, he said you could be on either side of the debate. You know, and I think the cable news networks are guilty of this as well. They put on Bill Nye and some climate denier, and it's one-on-one,
yeah.
Right? It's always one-on-one. But as John Oliver put out on, if you look up a YouTube video of a statistically representative climate change debate, he had 97 scientists and 3 deniers screaming at each other. It was a spoof, of course.
Yeah. But I don't think we can get 97 in the studio here.
We can in here, but if you know, I think part of the problem is always pretending that it is one to one, when in fact somehow we need to get the word out. And I think, again, in terms of conversation, it never helps to alienate people and attack them over this. But somehow you have to find where they're coming from and address what they're most concerned about.
Well, I got to say, it was a pleasure having you here, Donald Rod Bell of Union College. Great. You'll come back, right?
Whenever you call.
Because we have barely scratched the surface, and sorry to everybody who called and didn't make it in today. Support comes from Union College Concert Series. Presenting pianist Emmanuel Ax, the legendary pianist, closes the season with an all-Beethoven program Sunday, April 24th, 3 p.m., unioncollegeconcerts.org. Claire Pearson, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, for 14 years, offering plant spirit medicine and energy clearing for health, body, mind, and spirit, CLAREPearson.net. George Heigl, Cowan's representative, specializing in evaluating, marketing, buying, and selling of jewelry, fine art, historic firearms, American Indian art, and more, 518 469-7994, and Pelham Auto Service at the Amherst Belchertown line, located by the sign of the Flying Pig, a worker-owned and operated service repairing foreign cars since 1972, PelhamAuto.com. Thanks again to Professor Donald Rod Bell for being here. Thanks to you for listening and for all the great calls and email today. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered by Rose Schneider, our producer, who put this whole thing together. Jessica Blaustein Marshall, I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we'll talk carbon-based cars and automotive repairs. Stay tuned now for a news update.